Welcome to the Breaking Health Podcast, a series of discussions with the most disruptive CEOs and leaders in digital health.
Welcome to the Breaking Health Podcast. I am here with Steve Toll. Welcome, Steve, general partner at HLM. Glad to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it's fun times in the venture market, I guess, but we'll get to that in a second. I would love it if you could, we were talking a little bit before the program, how I think we both would agree we got into healthcare accidentally, but I'd like to hear your story about how you ended up in healthcare and how you ended up an operator and what was the transition to venture for you like?
Sure. Well, I'm a 30-year healthcare operator. I'm a product guy at heart. I think it's because I played with Legos and Matchbox cars as a kid, right? But I started actually in healthcare in college. I wanted to pay my way through school. And so I got a job working at Prudential at night, back when they had the Prucare HMO. And I worked in the mailroom, opening mail and microfilming claims at the end of the night. And by the time I graduated from college, I was running the night shift. And Prudential put me in a management training program, moved me to Houston, and I was off to the races. So it was a bit accidental, but I really loved it. And I love the work we did. And I've had the opportunity to work in a lot of different settings. Worked for, big managed care company. I went to work for Multiplan, right? PPO. Went to work for Pfizer, a big drug company. And then ultimately got into the tech side, worked for Allscripts, Optum, and then Merge Healthcare, which we sold to IBM. So I've worked on lots of different sides of healthcare.
I remember the Prudential business, by the way. Were you working in New Jersey? Is that where you were?
We were down in Houston. We ran a behavioral health carve-out business down there. But of course, spent a lot of time going back and forth to New Jersey for meetings.
Who was running Prudential Healthcare back then? Was it Sam?
It would have been. I mean, we were started by a guy named H.D. Whittington, who was a psychiatrist who ran the group.
Cool. So, first of all, I meant to tell people in the beginning, HLM is a Health Edge investor. So thank you.
We are.
Thank We're you happy for to be your confidence. But luckily, you can interview me after the show. This is my time, right?
Yeah.
But it looks like, so you went from Prudential, Multiplan, sort of similar, Allscripts maybe not so similar, certainly in pharmacy and then Optum and then into tech. Like, what was the transition like over that period of time? How did you see technology begin to sort of get into healthcare, right? Because we know that the adoption of technology isn't exactly seamless in healthcare.
Yeah, when I was at Pfizer, we did a bunch of analysis trying to figure out what the strategy of Pfizer should be. And this was back when Merck bought Medco, right? So Pfizer was trying to figure out what should our strategy be when it came to growth in the healthcare space. And the ultimate decision at the time was, let's not compete with our customers, but let's enable our customers. And we felt that technology was going to have a more and more important role in the life of a healthcare provider. And so we made some pretty interesting investments. We invested very early days in an electronic medical record business that was called PenChart that later became Amacor. And I think that's where I got my passion for doing the clinical side of healthcare is running that business for a group called Pfizer Health Solutions. But we did some really cool things under the Pfizer umbrella. We ran a disease management program that was very early days, taking risk for outcomes tied to pharmaceutical products. So we worked with the state of Florida. We worked with the NHS in England. We even worked with the government in Italy, in Puglia. And the concept was, how do we enable providers to take risk to manage patients based on outcomes? And we put our money where our mouth was in terms of pharmaceutical pricing. And this was, 26 years ago. So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then when Pfizer went through some challenging times because we had a pretty big drug trial fail, I decided to head out. And I met Glenn Tolman at a conference in Chicago. It was a PwC conference. And there was a contest. And the contest was, come up with an idea and sell it to the partners. So I won the contest, got to meet Glenn because he was one of the judges. Told him I was thinking about leaving Pfizer. And I actually interviewed, I did a phone interview for my job at Allscripts the morning I got married. Talking to Dan Michelson, he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm in Ireland getting married." He goes, "Why are you talking to me?" I said, "Well, I
need a job.
I need a job. I could be nervous or I could be, you know, focused." So I did my phone interview with Dan the day of my wedding.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Where do you think, so tell me about Merge. Was that your last operating role before coming into venture?
It was. Merge was an interesting business. It was a medical imaging business. So PACS and radiology, cardiology, orthopedics. And we had this concept as a company that we would do enterprise imaging. So the analog was Epic and Cerner were becoming enterprise clinical systems. And our belief was that the health system budgets were all gravitating away from departments and going to the CIO. So why wouldn't the CIO want to have one vendor to manage all their medical imaging? So I joined the firm to run product strategy and quickly took over all strategy for the firm. You know, we were publicly traded. We had done a massive roll-up of 8 or 9 companies, carried a ton of debt, but we had a great team. And we worked hard to get the products where they needed to be. And we were able to get into the artificial intelligence space. And that got IBM's attention. And I ran what I'll say visioneering in the process to get IBM excited about what was possible around disease identification and prediction using AI. And we sold for a great price.
And so you could have gotten a job as an operator anywhere after that. And you found yourself, let me ask you an honest question. Like, would you always sit there and think to yourself, I want to be that investor guy because he looks like they're having a good time over there.
I met the HLM team probably 17 or 18 years ago when I was at Pfizer. A buddy of mine said, you know, you need to go meet this guy Enrico. He's in town, go have dinner with him. So I met my partner Enrico Picoza for dinner. And I kind of stayed in touch with the group over the years. We'd meet at HIMSS every year. If they were doing a deal and they wanted some advice, you know, as part of the diligence, they'd talk to me about different segments. And we just stayed in touch over time. And so we sold the business to IBM. I had an earnout, survived the earnout by moving to Ireland and running global business development for them. And I started thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I really love the team at HLM. Great group of guys. Wasn't sure I wanted to move over and become an investor, but just given the background and the breadth of the markets that I've worked in, they felt like it was a pretty good fit. So I made the jump. I will tell you, making the jump from an operator to the venture side of the house is not easy. Mm-hmm. It's a very different cycle. You know, you're as an operator, you're busy every day. You got KPIs. You're driving to KPIs. As an investor, you're really, really busy, and then you're not really busy, right? It just depends on what deals you've got going on. So it is it's a different world, but I've had a good time in the last 3 years.
Yeah, you and I kind of have the opposite transition. I was an investor for a long time and became an operator. And I would say that's not an easy transition either, by the way. And now you're you've moved over to the investment side of the house. How does the portfolio look? Tell me about the HLM portfolio. What do you love in there that's exciting, and what are some of the themes that you've invested in up to this point?
You know, I would say that we're more of a growth investor. We're kind of famous for doing Series A and B investments historically. You know, we were very early in Teladoc. We actually invested in Teladoc when they were getting sued by the Texas Medical Association, and their CEO hadn't even started. They were changing CEOs, right? But we knew that there was huge potential for disruption in the telehealth space because of access to care as a fundamental premise that we like to invest in. We were early in Phreesia, you know, a company that hit the window perfectly when it comes to high deductible medical plans and people having to pay when they go to the doctor. You know, cash collection became really important. So our portfolio is focused on behavioral health. You know, 9 or 10 investments in behavioral health. We think that space is only going to get more important because it's an enormous epidemic. We like patient and member engagement. We think you don't really make a difference until you get members and patients engaged to make change in their health. And we've made a number of investments in that space. Impulse is one of our great investments there. We love tech-enabled services. We just recently exited Nordic Consulting, which is a fantastic company, but we like tech-enabled services. And so those are the areas we like to play in. More recently, we've been focused on moving care into the home. You know, $265 billion of Medicare spend, about 25% of that spend we think could be moving into the home. And so we think that's a great space to be playing in. And then we're also continuing to look at specialization when it comes to telehealth or specialization when it comes to behavioral health. And a combination of the two, obviously. But, you know, whether it's stimulants or opioids, on the behavioral health side, we're continuing to look in those areas. We also have an investment in the workers' comp space, which is tied to behavioral health, because in some cases, getting people back to work has a behavioral health aspect to it.
All right. I want to dig in to a couple of things there. Let's start with behavioral health, because you know, I remember just listening to your background in healthcare. I remember sort of investing in stuff that was peripheral to your progression. And, you know, I remember behavioral health was EAP. tell us about, first of all, what is the problem that the behavioral health companies that you're investing in are trying to solve? Is it the linkage between overall health and behavioral health? Generally speaking, where are the hot areas to sort of look at?
Yeah, I think it's fundamentally two things. Access to care is probably the biggest issue, because it's very inconsistent depending on where you live, and there's a looming shortage. I think the numbers are that about 500,000 healthcare providers short by 2026, which is a big problem in terms of access. And you know, some of the national payers believe that one of our national goals should be making sure people can have urgent behavioral health care within 5 days of onset of a crisis. And in this country, that is not possible today. So we think access is a big issue. And then the other issue is whole person care or coordinated care. You know, there are some people who think, I think it was McKinsey that says we could save $185 billion just by coordinating care, because over half of people with physical issues have corresponding behavioral issues, but oftentimes aren't treated. So there is an opportunity from a whole person perspective. And so the companies we've invested in predominantly started around access, you know, whether it was a telehealth company or a behavioral health company that focused on providing an on-call provider in a physical location, like a rural hospital or a prison, right? Mm-hmm. But more recently, we've looked at the whole person coordinated care side of the world too.
So when you say access to behavioral health, are you thinking access to basically talk therapy? Is that what you think the first?
Yeah, CBT therapy is what I'm talking about. Yeah.
And is the conditions that's most prevalent there, is it depression? Is it anxiety? What are people not getting care for?
Yeah, I think, you know, the majority of the cases are going to be the garden variety depression, anxiety. That's where you have, from a commercially insured population, just big swath of population that need help. And it's episodic, right? Sometimes it gets more severe than others. Then you've got the whole substance abuse side of the world, which did get worse during the pandemic. And so that's an area that we recently put money into a company called Wayspring that's starting to focus on value-based care when it comes to substance abuse disorders. So that's an area that continues to be a problem nationwide. So we look at both of those sides of the coin.
So tell me more about Wayspring. I think I understand what they're doing, but you know, value-based care is a small statement that captures a lot of ideas. So how do you do value-based care and behavioral health exactly?
Well, they started out as a company called Axial, and they changed their name as they brought in a new leadership team and pivoted. But they started focusing on a platform that would identify patients who were at risk for substance abuse disorder, and at the same time identify providers who could use some coaching and some education around appropriateness of prescribing patterns. And so this was a SaaS analytics platform that was pretty effective at identifying members that needed help. But the real opportunity is really the intervention. So how do you take the members that you find that need help and surround them with a multifaceted team. So social workers and substance abuse counselors and peers who have recovered. How do you put a team around them? And then how do you take risk for those lives? So how do you go, you know, on a PMPM basis, how do you take risk for those lives and for corresponding cost of care tied to those patients? So it's early days for this shift into value-based care for Wayspring, but it is an enormous market and I think a great opportunity. And we love that leadership team.
Is the substance abuse still around opiates or is it alcohol and drugs? Or all
it's, it's multifaceted. It's everything, even stimulants. And, you know, there are some proven medical interventions for some of these, and for others, there aren't interventions. So we've even looked at digital therapeutics, for example, for stimulant abuse. We didn't make the investment. The company was too early for us, but it's an area where you don't have a methadone equivalent. And so people are using games as a way to try to treat people who might be addicted to stimulants.
Addict them to games and get them off the drugs.
That's right. And give them the right incentives to change their behavior.
All right. So tell me about member engagement. I, you know, as you know, we got a little member engagement going on at Health Edge. We've got components of that. We have a part of our company called WellFrame that does member engagement, but it's a big word. It's a big idea. What are your thoughts as an investor around a member engagement or patient engagement? I like the patient engagement side actually quite a bit, but tell me what you
think. Depends on who you're selling to, right? I think it's a big deal when you look at how do you get a person to become aware of their health condition, and then how do you get them to make a change in their behavior. You really can't get to scale clinically with some of these programs that are out there unless you can convince people that they've got a problem they need to address and that it's worth addressing, and then give them the support as they start their journey. So we've got a couple of investments in that space. We've got Impulse that primarily sells to payers. And then we've got Linkwell, which is a company that Linkwell Health that does the content development. They're actually experts at working with payers to build content, because the content, what you say and how you say it, is as important or sometimes more important than the channels, the technology to deliver it, right? And then we've got Be Well Connected Health, which primarily today focuses on health systems and retail pharmacy, but they're moving into the payer space. But they focus on engaging digitally with consumers and creating these health journeys. How do you get someone to take a health journey and stay engaged? And it really comes down to the lifetime value of that person to the health system in the community and the lifetime value of that person to the payer. If you think about what's happening in primary care, you know, if you look at what Amazon just recently did in their purchase, you've got an environment where there are a lot of people trying to engage with people in our communities who could become lifetime customers. And right. And the lifetime value of those customers is significant. And so it doesn't matter whether you're a community hospital or a big fancy academic hospital. In fact, the academic guys probably have a bigger problem, because if they need to fill their tertiary care services, which are the real high value services, they need a lot of people in their funnel.
Right.
So we think, you know, patient engagement is really about loyalty, and it's about trust, and how do you build that over time? So the companies we've invested in are really best in class in this area.
Cool. Last piece. I clearly CVS Health agrees with you that moving care into the home is something that's going to happen, right? They're about to spend
$8 billion. Yeah, big bet
behind that idea. How do you invest in something like that at the growth equity stage, or the later stage venture side of things? What's out there to look at?
Yeah, so you know, we call ourselves stage intentional, which means, you know, we're not just a Series A or B investor. Our last fund, we did a seed round with a previous leadership team that we had a great result. So, you know, reinvested in the people. We did I led a couple Series C's. We did three, participated in three private equity recaps. So we are stage intentional, which means we're looking for the best deals in our space. So we are financial investors. We're not going to pay high multiples. You know, we are definitely, you know, trying to find the right deal at the right price. But given, you know, given the network, given that we've been doing this for 30 years, we're the oldest healthcare venture firm out there. We've got a good network, and we're able to get into deals that others may not be able to get into. And that's helped us quite a bit in the last couple of cycles. And we've been through, you know, if you think about the last 30 years and the cycles that we've been through as investors, we've been through the dot bomb, right? We've been through 08, we've been through 18. So, you know, we've been through these different cycles, and you do have to change your approach to investing at each turn of the cycle. And in fact, going into a recession is probably the best time to make investments. You get better deals. But we're always looking at companies around, I'm a product guy, right? So I look at companies around a product market fit. So I actually have this 6-point test that I put companies through before I look at the deal economics, right? Because that's just how I think. Yeah. First thing I look at is, are they solving a problem that a customer knows they have? Second thing is, the customer willing to spend money to solve that problem? Because we all have problems that we know we have that we're not really spending money on, right? Third thing is, are they willing to spend the money now? Because timing is everything. Are they willing to spend the money with you as a vendor? And then, is the market big enough where you can get to scale and we can get a good exit? And is there enough of a competitive moat where the company we're putting money into has some advantage? And so we're really assessing, as we make an investment, where will this company be in 5 to 7 years? And do we think it's going to get to the kind of underwriting return that we believe it needs to get to in order to put money in? So we look at every deal the same way, but later stage deals, you're obviously going to have a higher price you're paying because it's a de-risked opportunity, right?
Yeah.
But that 6-point test for me is always what I'm looking at. And you can have the best company in the world, the best technology. If no one's going to buy it, it does not matter. Or if it's a bleeding early company and timing's off, it doesn't matter. Yeah. So you really have to assess every opportunity, I think, in that way. At least that's how I do it.
Yeah. And I think all of us have probably convinced ourselves that those tests were passing. Only to find out where maybe they're not, right? There is a binomial distribution oftentimes in these investments.
For
right?
sure. For sure.
And I think that's awesome. I love that. I like that model quite a bit. And on the home health, what are problems companies are trying to solve today that they're willing to pay for today in home health?
Yeah, we just put money into a company that focuses on a very specialized population, the IDD population. And the state Medicaid programs. You know, imagine, and I've got a relative who falls into that category. And imagine, it's hard enough to get someone to the emergency room if they've got physical limitations. But the minute they're intellectually disabled, it is an extraordinarily challenging event to get someone to the urgent care, to the emergency department. And so it's a company that's focused on really being available 24/7 for caregivers of IDD patients. And it can make an enormous difference. And some of these things could be very simple, a medication change or medication adherence, right? But the last thing you want to do is try to get someone who is really challenging physically or behaviorally to the emergency room. So that's a recent example of a very specialized investment in home care that we think serves a very expensive and very needy population. So that's how we're looking at, you know, not just the garden variety opportunities around delivering care in the home, but there are some great niches out there that underserved populations, high cost populations, where you really can make a difference and scale a business that will be very valuable.
So, these three themes, behavioral member engagement, moving healthcare into the home, is that still a driving force of what you're investing in today? Is there anything else that you're wanting to see today in stage appropriate companies that you look like?
We'll always,
like I always used to say, I'd like to, you know, I'll talk to anybody. I'll listen to anything, right? If somebody's got a good idea, but I'd sure like to know at some way what I'd like to see, so that when I see it, I know I've found it. You know what I mean?
You know, I continue to look at precision medicine, just given my background in artificial intelligence. I think that in the next 5 to 7 years, we're going to see some we'll start to see some investable businesses in the precision medicine space using deep learning to identify disease and predict disease and tailor treatment plans that are specific to the person's background or genetic makeup. I do believe that's coming. And I think you're going to see some crossovers between traditional therapeutics and digital therapeutics. So I think that's a space that's interesting over time. We also look at value-based care enablement. You know, 40% of reimbursement last year was tied to some type of alternative payment model. So we've looked at, you know, companies doing chronic care management. We've looked at companies doing physician practice management. It's a broad space, but we think that's an area that needs some attention because there are great opportunities there. So I would say really it's behavioral health, patient engagement, value-based care enablement, access to care, and then tech-enabled services broadly.
Cool. So thanks for joining, by the way. It's fun to talk to you.
Yeah.
So maybe we can leave people with a couple of tips. So let me ask you a statistical question. Maybe you'll know the answer. How many business plans do you think you read a year?
Oh, Lord. We probably see a couple hundred companies a year.
And
that's at the partner level. Our analysts are looking at a lot more than that. But at the partner level, probably a couple hundred companies.
And how many investments do you make a year?
Three on average.
Okay. So what do you think the key is to be the 3 out of 200 that gets the money? Give, you know, we've got entrepreneurs and that listen to this podcast as part of our audience, and I'm sure they'd love to understand, like, when they come to see you, what do you want to know? Obviously, your 6 points would be the starting point, right?
Yeah, I think you got to remember that investors have the shortest attention span on the earth,
Well, CEOs are close too, by the way. Okay.
Well, I would say that too. Yeah. But you know, if you think about it, you've got 5 minutes in my mind, maybe 7 minutes to make your case so that people will continue to pay attention. So you really got to grab them immediately and make the elevator pitch early on why your company and how big is this market. Then you can get into the details. You know, I can't tell you, and I I've been doing this only 3 years. I've got partners who've been doing this 30 years. And I asked them when I first started doing this, how do you sit through some of these pitches and still come up with meaningful questions to ask? And they said, it's hard. You know, it's really hard. But if I were pitching, very quickly get to the meat of why now, and how do you scale? And then you can go back and fill in the details. Do your homework. You know, you've got to do your homework because every firm has their specific patterns of what they like to invest in. We typically invest in companies that have direct reimbursement for their services because we don't believe there's any real soft money out there anymore. And we like to make investments in companies that are doing 5 to 10 million in revenue. So do your homework and know who you're pitching to and then get a warm introduction. Don't go in cold because that's never going to work because we are investing in people and teams. And so knowing those teams and knowing those people is critical. Kind of like how I got this gig. You know, it's because I knew these guys for so many years. And I was on their advisory board for 3 years before they hired me. So, it is all about relationships at the end of the day. And so doing your homework and getting a warm introduction through someone that's trusted is probably the best path for anybody.
How do you judge a founder? Like, how can you tell?
So I think there are, you know, there are two kinds of traditional founders. You've got the sales friendly founder that can light up a room and maybe isn't that, you know, sharp on the details of the market, but they could sell anything. And then you've got the really strong technical founders that couldn't light a paper bag on fire, right?
Yeah.
We're looking for someone who has both of those skills, and it's rare to find that founder who can go toe to toe with someone who's very deep in the weeds, but who can really light a room on fire. That's who you want to put money into, because you know that they're watching the market and you know that they can adjust, because every business has to adjust, right? And so that's who we like to find, is that rare founder that has both of those skills.
That's cool. That's a great way to put it. I will tell you, it's true. I mean, I think to build a company from zero or even 5 or 10 million. I mean, just because you get to 5 or 10 million, I've seen plenty of companies get to 5 or 10 million and never grow from there, or subsequently lose their market. You really have to be an expert at least in what your company's doing. You may not have to know how to sit at a desk and write the code or whatever, but you've got to like know how to run part of the business. And then at the same time, you're going to pretty much close every order until you get to 50 million and above.
That's right.
You've got to be able to have that sense of, and I actually like the technical guy that can sell, because they sell differently. Like they kind of always start with this very sort of tangible approach to getting people.
And they're usually more reserved, so they're not as flashy, but then they surprise you and they can actually sell you. That's what I love about a good founder.
Yeah. It's like all of a sudden, and then of course you really have to find somebody that has to learn, because the being running a business changes every day. And most of these founders, you know, are missing 50% of what maybe a seasoned CEO might know. And a seasoned CEO is getting 50% blind spots anyway. You know what I mean?
Well, I actually asked I led a Series B for a company a couple of years ago, and I asked the founder, CEO, I said, what do you want to be when you grow up? Do you want to be the CEO? And she was a little taken aback by that. And I said, hear me out. I said, at some point, being CEO is about managing your board, managing a balance sheet. It's not about being deep into the product and driving product innovation. And so at some point, you have to be self-aware enough to know what you want to be when you grow up. Yeah. And she's a remarkable leader. And she's one of these very rare CEOs who can go toe-to-toe with the nerdiest technician and at the same time can light a room on fire. So that's what I love about it.
All right, last question. How can people find you? Are you tweeting, LinkedIn?
I'm on LinkedIn. On our website at HLM Venture Partners, you can submit stuff to us. But LinkedIn's probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay. That's great. Nice talking to you. It's fun.
Yeah.
I feel like a venture capitalist again. It's kind of nice.
Well, it's great to spend the time. Thanks so much.
All right.